Each year in sports, records are shattered and championships are won. But the highly paid analysts get to tell you what to think about it. Who's listening to us, the fans?
This is Talk Back, where real fans get to express their own opinions and engage in heated debates about the world of sports as we see it. Welcome to the show.
We're back on another edition of Talk Back, and Justin, I'm excited to talk to you this week about not only the NFC East and getting into the NFC side of things, but there's a lot of news that we're going to have to get into in segment two and current events, just going over a little bit of what's occurred with injuries over the AFC divisions that we've spent the last 4 weeks talking about.
It seems like the first really handful of shows that we did, there was just big topics that we had because the NFL really wasn't in season. We were sort of at the end of the NBA year when we really started the podcast, and now we get a lot of breaking news coming in, so we actually get to sort of banter back and forth on a lot of topics and kind of keep things moving a little quicker, which I think our audience is going to enjoy.
Yeah, so in segment one of this week's episode, we will do the NFC East as we kick off the NFC divisional previews for the NFL season coming up, and then in segment two, we will hit on current events, and we've got some fun current events that rather than doing one big segment for one, one topic, we're going to just kind of go through a bunch, and then we'll do our traditional lightning round there at the end.
Yeah, when we get to the lightning round, I also have a fun question for you about your favorite NBA player, your buddy Steph Curry.
Oh, so, I thought you were going to say Kyrie Irving. Okay.
I don't think I can blend it into that one, but I think you'll enjoy it. So we'll get to that and more when we come right back after this.
Well, as a lot of you know, we've talked Justin's favorite team, the Denver Broncos, and my favorite team, the New York Jets. But interestingly enough, because I'm from Pennsylvania for over 20 years now, my other favorite team is the Philadelphia Eagles, and I've never felt that really conflicted because, A, they're in different divisions, different conferences, and B, the two of them are never likely to play in a Super Bowl against each other. So I don't have a problem with rooting one or the other. They just don't cause any conflict for me. But as we hit up the NFC East this week, we'll certainly talk about those Eagles along with the Cowboys, Redskins, and Giants. So Justin, as we've done in past weeks, I think the listeners are enjoying the fact that we go through the Vegas lines for over-under on total wins in the season. We talk about the players a little bit, who's going to be relevant, who's going to be fantasy relevant on each roster, and then kind of work down through what we think is going to be the end result in the division. So as you're looking at the standings, who's Vegas want at the top, who they want at the bottom, and we'll kind of go from there.
A little bit of a surprise to me was that Vegas actually has Washington at 7.5 wins, which seems like a little bit of a surprise that they would be last in the division. What's your thoughts on that?
I would say to you on that, just my initial reaction is the fact that Washington doesn't have a running back that jumps off the page. Now, I know you and I texted and we wanted to talk a little bit about Terrell Pryor coming onto the roster at wide receiver and what kind of value he brings. And then we've also a couple weeks ago had the segment about Kirk Cousins and whether or not he would sign, a tender with the team and or just be tagged for another year. So we've got the whole Cousins drama going on. And my initial reaction on them being 7.5, I'd be nervous to take the over only because they're already going to beat up each other on the division. And I don't see a running back who's going to, just be a stud on the roster. They've got some talent there. I mean, Jordan Reed's probably their best offensive player outside of maybe what Terrell Pryor ends up doing. What's your feeling on the roster offensively? Do you see a guy like Crowder or Doxson stepping up to kind of bolster Pryor coming in? Do you think Cousins has a gangbusters year to boost his value so that he can take off? I mean, those are things going through my mind when I look at the Redskins.
I really like the Redskins offensively. I really think they did a nice job of filling in the pieces that they really lost last year. And 2 years ago, it seemed like they drafted Josh Doxson with the thought being, okay, Garcon and DeSean Jackson are free agents in the same year. We're probably going to lose one, if not both, just the way that our roster's constructed and the whole contract situations with Cousins. So to get a guy like Terrell Pryor on a one-year prove-it type deal, I think is a really nice move for them. Again, with Garcon and DeSean Jackson both leaving, that's 214 targets between them that they got. So those target share are going to have to go to someone. So when you have Terrell Pryor, you have Josh Doxson, Jamison Crowder had a very nice year last year. Jordan Reed is always, when he's healthy, a very dominant tight end in this league. So they have four really good skill position players there, pass catchers really, that I think can help Cousins because the narrative is going to be the same as last year. If Cousins doesn't get off to a good start while he's pressing, he's upset about the contract. If he does get up to a good start, it's going to be the opposite. Why didn't we sign this guy long term? What is happening? So that narrative is going to play out all season. But on the field, I actually like the Redskins' pass catchers a lot. And even Robert Kelly, you know, in the nine games he started, had a pretty good run there last year. And they also remember they drafted Piran from Oklahoma, who was a guy that had, I believe, 51 rushing and receiving touchdowns in 36 games. So that's a guy that can get to the end zone, average 6 yards to carry over 3 years. So I think from a skill position standpoint offensively, they've got some weapons.
Well, I can't argue with that, except that I'm not as excited as you are at the running back position. And with what's behind Cousins and what his motivations may or may not be, my concern is that, as I said, as they beat up on each other in the division, and then they have some tough outside of division games as well, I don't know that I would argue with Vegas with Redskins being in fourth place. Maybe the only team that could battle them for fourth place is the Giants.
Well, I think the Redskins, their schedule, again, we alluded to it some last week in talking about the AFC West, was, you know, the NFC East is going to play the AFC West, but they do get a little bit of a break with playing the NFC West. So you do get the Cardinals, you do get the Rams, and you do get the 49ers, you know, teams that all missed the playoffs last year. So I think that will help them some. They're out-of-division games. They get the Vikings and Saints, which won't be easy games for them. But again, when you're talking about 7.5, this team was last year did go 8-7-1. So they do seem to have the pedigree to be around that 8-8 mark. I just think the moves that they made when you lose guys like Garcon and like DeSean Jackson, when you can get a Terrell Pryor, and if you've seen some of the videos from him in camp and going against Josh Norman every day, that can only make him better. Supposedly worked out with Antonio Brown and Randy Moss this offseason, really trying to really refine this craft. And remember, this was a guy that was a quarterback that was suspended by the league when he came in for the stuff he did at Ohio State. And now we're talking about him being, you know, one of the top wide receivers in the game, and certainly the wide receiver one for Washington. But I think it really comes down to, how does Josh Doctson, does he take a step forward? Because it seems like he's had a good camp, but again, he's injured now with a hamstring. Do those little things keep taking him off the field where they can't get that consistency? Same with Jordan Reed. Can he stay healthy and stay on the field? If they do, I think this offense can be dynamic and sort of overcome the run game, because it wasn't that great last year and they still were able to win 8. So if that can happen, and again, remember last year, DeSean Jackson wasn't healthy again the entire year. So for them, it's can their top guys stay healthy in order to help Cousins and sort of overcome some of the issues they have with the run game.
So are you taking the over on 7.5?
I like the Redskins to win 8. Okay. I can see them winning 8, so I think I would feel comfortable taking them to win 8. They went 3-3 in the division last year. They could have easily beat Dallas in week 2. They should have beat Dallas in week 2 if Cousins doesn't throw that late pick when they're driving. So I can definitely see this team going 8-8, so I feel comfortable taking the over.
Who would you put on your team from this roster in season long, and then who do you target in daily?
I really like Terrell Pryor. I think for a season long, you know, even last year with the issues with the Browns, he was still, you know, 77 receptions, over 1,000 yards, 4 TDs, and the Browns had nothing around him. Coleman was hurt some. You're talking about throwing in Kessler and Robert Griffin III. And
what was the reason the Browns got rid of him? I really didn't catch up on that.
I think they just let him go. He was just a free agent.
Yeah, I was surprised that he just was out there. And when the Redskins picked him up, I thought it was a good pickup.
Yeah, I mean, a one-year deal for $8 million. You know, again, it's a prove-it type deal. You know, he's going to be motivated. He's going to want that big contract. So I definitely think for a season long, I think he has the most consistency. A guy who really in daily kind of popped up was Jamison Crowder. Now, he doesn't seem to have the touchdown upside, so I don't necessarily think he's a great tournament play. But from a cash perspective, when you get a guy that get in a PPR league that's going to get 7 or 8 catches for, you know, if he can hit that 100-yard bonus that can get you 20 points for his salary, he's a guy that can get sneaky good, that can kind of creep under the radar. And even it'll be interesting, Robert Kelly, as the season goes on. He's going to start out cheap in fantasy. He'll be a guy that's probably under-owned because a lot of people will overlook Washington's run game. So it'll be interesting how Washington uses him. I'm very curious as the preseason starts this week to see the progression of Washington's run game and see how he looks.
So you'll take the over. You'll take them at 8. I'm going to take the under. I say they go 7-9 this year. They're not going to get that dinky little tie that they got last year.
My brother's not going to be happy with you.
Well, I know, and he could beat me up too, so I got to be careful. But yeah, I'm going to say that they're 7-9. So who does Vegas say is going to be in third then?
Your beloved Philadelphia Fly Eagles Fly.
There's no way.
8.
Not a chance.
Is the magic number.
Not a chance. I'm taking the over. I'll take it over in $50 right now.
Oh, man.
There's just no way. I mean, everything I'm reading about Carson Wentz, some of the beat writers out of Philly say that his camp, even so far, is going very well. And you add a guy like LeGarrette Blount, who, you know, we don't know how long LeGarrette Blount's got left and how much he's got left in the tank, but he shows flashes, and he is a tough runner. certainly tougher than Matthews. Ryan Matthews, we don't know if his hip's going to fall out of its socket. We don't know if his shin is going to hold up. I mean, he is just fragile. He has been ever since he was with the Chargers. So I'm thrilled that they went out and got Blount. And then look at what they did at wide receiver. Tell me they didn't get better at wide receiver.
No, they absolutely did. I mean, what they did to Carson Wentz last year was criminal with the guys they put around him. Josh Huff, and I mean, even Jordan Matthews being the number one, there's talk that through camp that he might be the odd man out. They've moved Nelson Aguilar to the inside. Now you've got Alshon Jeffrey on one side, Torrey Smith on the other, and potentially Aguilar playing in the slot. Jordan Matthews, who was their number one, may be out. So they definitely got better, by far improved themselves at the wide receiver position because they were dreadful last year. I mean, Dorial Green-Beckham got 74 targets. I don't even know if he got signed by anybody. I mean,
I don't think so. Not that I'm aware of.
You know, that's just how bad that they're the players they put around Carson Wentz. And you're talking about a guy that was from North Dakota State coming into the league as the second pick, and you throw him in as a starter on an NFL team and you put no weapons around him. So what they did, they made massive changes. The only thing that scares me about this team is they were 7-9 last year, but the Cowboys gifted them a win in week 17. So really, this was a 6-10 team.
Well, let's look at the beginning of the season. How many wins the Eagles gifted to other people as well?
But I just think when they were basically 2-4 in the division with that Cowboy win, if Dallas is playing in that game, it beats them, they're 1-5. So in my mind, are they going to be able to go 3-3 in this division and then find, if you're taking the over, looking at 6 more wins? To me, that's what scares me with this team, is to think that they could really were a 6-10 team that got fortunate, went 7-9, to think that they're going to be able to jump 3 more wins. That scares me. I feel like they're on that 8-8 type team. I would not feel comfortable going with them with the over just because I think they improved, but I think last year they had that great start. Then they kind of got hit in the middle and then they were just kind of on and off there. They had a great win week 16 versus the Giants, but it still scares me to think that they were probably 6-10, really should have been 1-5 in the division. Can they take that big of a step? And this division, I think when you get, you know, I disagree on the Giants. I think the Giants could easily win this division. Will be tough with some of the moves they've made, especially defensively what they've done. I just think that this is a tough division, plus playing the AFC West, it's going to be tough to find, in my opinion, find those 8-9 wins for them.
Well, we'll talk about the Giants in a minute because as a Jets fan, looking at Geno Smith backing up Eli Manning, you better hope that Eli Manning doesn't get hurt.
He's very durable.
Then you can forget about them winning the division with Geno Smith. I look at the Eagles roster offensively and I say they're going to put up 30 to 40 points per week on paper, right? I see Zach Ertz taking that next step, hopefully, and He's a tight end that I think really could be in that Jordan Reed category. I don't want to say Rob Gronkowski. He's not in that category. But you're looking at guys like Delanie Walker and Travis Kelce. And Zach Ertz has the body type and the physical ability to do that. He's got to stay healthy. I mean, as any NFL player does, he has to stay healthy. He's had some issues on and off the field, even for quarters at a time. But if you have Ertz there, and they're talking in practice in training camp that Alshon Jeffrey and Carson Wentz have formed an immediate rapport. Alshon's just grabbing balls out of the air that they weren't doing last year with Jordan Matthews. And then the other thing I'm impressed with is this young kid, Aguilar. He, by all accounts, has studied and worked hard in the offseason. He was a guy that I would have been happy if they let him go last year. Some of the drops that he had that
you
were
and everyone else in Philly
absolutely ridiculous. And so the fact that he rose up over the offseason, came back strong, and now they're talking about sliding him in to an underneath the slot and having that work in the offense with Jeffrey and Smith on the outside. And it's exciting to me because I don't see Wentz regressing. I know you and I talked about this last year, that defenses maybe started to figure him out a little bit. But look, if we look at that draft, and I know we're going to talk about the NFC West in a few weeks, but thankfully the Eagles found Wentz and were spared the Goff, you know, the Goff experiment.
Yeah, they were definitely lucky to get
the we'll certainly talk about that. But Wentz coming over to us is a fantastic thing. I think he's our franchise quarterback. And yeah, I'm telling you right now, we'll do this podcast for the next, you know, couple of months as the season rolls out. And I'll definitely buy you a round of golf if the Eagles don't hit the over on that.
Alshon is definitely the guy that's the most intriguing on this team from a fantasy perspective. But for me, Alshon has always been the injuries. The soft tissue injuries for him just mount up every year. In the 5 seasons he's been in the NFL, he's played 6 games, 14, 16, 8, and 12. His issue is he can't stay on the field. When he does, I think he will by far be Wentz's favorite target because he is a guy that can go high point the football. He's a red zone target. He's tough to match up with because he's such a big guy. He can get position. He's an easy target for a guy like Wentz. So if he can stay healthy, I think from a season-long perspective and even daily, he's going to be definitely a guy. And like you said, LeGarrette Blount's another guy coming in. He's going to take Ryan Matthews' carries. And as bad as Ryan Matthews was last year, he found a way to get to the end zone 8 times. And you know LeGarrette Blount can get to the end zone. So if he's going to get all the goal line work and he can eat into some of that share Matthews has, he's another guy that can have a very, very productive season and probably get potentially double-digit touchdowns.
Who's going to be your fantasy pick?
I think it's those two, Alshon for me and LeGarrette Blount. Yeah. I think are the two guys to look at. You know, Torrey Smith is such a boomer bust guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is a tournament dart throw for daily fantasy. And I got to see Nelson Aguilar with my own eyes in the regular season to believe it.
Yeah.
I think I'm like everybody else in Philly. I got to see that to believe it because the boo birds are waiting.
Well, my fantasy team in one of my leagues last year, the name of it, I was proud of myself. I was creative for once. I came up with it. It was Ertz Gotta Be Wentz. And so, you know, I'm going with Wentz in season long and Ertz in season long. I think those are solid and their floors are high enough that I don't feel like there's a lot of risk there. Their ceilings probably aren't as high as others. But I like them in season long, and I got to go with you on the daily fantasy expertise. Whatever you tell me to take in daily fantasy, I'll take. So you're telling me that you think the Giants can win this division. Who does Vegas have as the second most for wins in the over-under category?
Well, Vegas doesn't agree with me because okay. They actually have in second the Giants at 9. So the Giants coming off 11-5 last year. The big moves for them was getting Brandon Marshall in the offseason, and that was a position really they needed to find some help to try to get, number one, get more of a mentor and a veteran presence around Odell Beckham to sort of settle him down when the wheels start falling off the bus.
And Brandon Marshall's the right guy for that?
Well, he's got a lot of history. He's got a lot to pull from to help the man.
Well, at least he didn't have to move very far.
Yeah, and they had to get him out of the locker room with Sheldon Richardson for those two killed each other as
yeah,
well.
But they're probably still neighbors there in the Meadowlands.
Yeah, like locker room buddies. But I think that's a nice move for them just from the standpoint that it sort of takes some of that pressure off. You can't just continue to throw double teams at Beckham all the time without having to worry about Brandon Marshall. And then you still have Sterling Shepard on the inside. So they did a nice job with that receiving core. What stands out for you for the Giants?
What stands out for me is that Manning is just continuing to get older. I don't feel like he has...
That's not very nice.
Well, we all are, right? I don't feel like he has a lot of good years left in him. I've already sensed a decline. Now, his stats really aren't bad. I mean, he just isn't flashy. So you get that Manning curse of just doing a really solid job for a lot of years and no one really talks about you. But if he goes down, I mean, and look, we keep saying this over and over and over. And when we get to the current event segment next, we're going to talk about guys who have already gone down in spring training. And so that changes everything, of course. If Manning goes down, there's no way in heck they're making the playoffs. Then I look at their running backs. You know, they tried a three-headed committee last year, and they really haven't changed that. You still have Perkins and Vereen and Darkwood there. I don't know who's going to rise up out of them. Maybe Perkins, if he gets the load, he does the job. Certainly their receiving core is phenomenal. Beckham Jr. is one of the best I've ever seen catch a football in spurts. Now his attitude is going to be his biggest downfall. He reminds me a lot of a guy like Terrell Owens. Marshall, good for them for picking him up at such a good price for a short contract. I mean, that's just a smart move by the GM. And Shepard excited me, but you know, with the news of him rolling his ankle, I'm a little nervous about him, of course, but I just don't see them. I guess we disagree on that. I just don't see them having that firepower. And maybe it's because the guy at the helm, I would rather have, and I know I'm a homer, but I would rather have Carson Wentz throwing these great receivers a football than Eli Manning right now.
Well, Eli is still a two-time Super Bowl champion, and he doesn't do anything that looks... I mean, he has no personality. He just always looks the same. You don't know if he's thrown an interception or a touchdown. So the Giants are never a flashy team. They remind me a little bit of like the NFC version of the Chiefs. It's like they don't really look on paper like they're that flashy. Now, they do have Beckham, who's by far maybe the flashiest player in the league. But when you look at them from a roster standpoint outside of Beckham, they just nobody really seems to pop at you. But they find a way to win games. Even last year's team, same thing. They still found a way to win 11 games, and they've been able to add Brandon Marshall. They added Evan Engram through the draft. I really like their secondary with Landon Collins back there at safety. I mean, that's a guy that reminds me a lot of like a Troy Polamalu, Ed Reed type guy that just makes things happen. He's always around the football making plays. I think defensively will be, as the season wears on, you get into November and December when it's not just the offensive shows from the air. I think that's really when this team will start to play their best football, because you have Jenkins, you have Dominic Rogers-Kamara, Eli Apple. You know, you still have Pierre Paul up front, Olivier Vernon. I think defensively is where they have a lot of really good players and some depth, where they're going to be able to win some games in November and December just through their defense. Their run game is absolutely probably the scariest part of this roster. Is, you know, Paul Perkins flashed. He certainly had some moments in the Green Bay game, in the playoff game. You know, they've gotten rid of Rashard Jennings. So, you know, he will be the guy. Can he step forward? But with the pass catchers they have, Eli's certainly not afraid to throw it 35 or 40 times a game. And you got guys that aren't scared to have a lot of target share. So hopefully they can overcome that. But I just felt like, you know, they still found a way to win 11 games last year. And they weren't that flashy of a team, and they've been able to get better.
Well, you make a compelling argument, and they were 11-5 last year. So you're taking the over on 9?
I think they can get to 10. So I feel comfortable that. So I would definitely take the over on 9 for them.
And I think fantasy is pretty obvious with them. I mean, without a running back committee that's flashy or anything, and Manning is certainly going to be solid but not great. I think, and unless I'm wrong, I think Beckham Jr. and Marshall are the plays.
Yeah, there's no sense to try to get fancy. Odell Beckham is going to have probably 150-plus targets. Brandon Marshall, I think, for the last decade has the most red zone targets of anybody in terms of a pass catcher. So he's always a threat for the red zone. And obviously, if you get touchdowns in fantasy, it can sort of mask some of the fact that, you know, he's a little bit older. He's probably not going to have those top end, you know, 100 plus yard receiving games or, you know, 10 plus catches. But if he can get you 6 catches for 70 yards and get a score, that's still a really nice game in PPR.
Well, don't ask me why, but in Central Pennsylvania, there are still a lot of Dallas Cowboys fans around here. So this next team is going to make them very happy, because they were 13-3 last year. Obviously had a fantastic year. I was super impressed with Dak Prescott. I mean, the guy was really, really solid. And I was a proponent for keeping him. Even though it hurts the Eagles, it hurts my rooting interest. I was certain that they should keep him over Tony Romo, and the guard had changed. Zeke Elliott, again, another just a fantastic rookie performance. You have your stalwarts at wide receiver. Nothing really flashy has changed there. And then another ageless wonder in Jason Witten, is still at tight end, and all words, you know, say that he looks good in camp. So apparently he's just going to play until he's 40 like Tom Brady. But do you see them winning 13 games again this year? And Vegas has them at what, 9.5?
Vegas has them at 9.5.
So do you take the over, and do you see them getting to 13 again?
I like the over, but I don't like 13. I feel like they can, again, they'll be up there at 10, 11 wins just from the fact that their offensive line is so dominant. Now, Zeke Elliott has to figure out a way to stop doing stupid things to draw the league ire. Because it's already getting reported, you know, Chris Carter had some stuff on Fox Sports 1 that, you know, some of his sourcing seems like this is a Brady-type situation where maybe some evidence tampering, you know, could be in that 2-4 game ratio is what they're thinking. Now, you don't know what the appeal process will be, but it certainly seems like Zeke Elliott is going to get suspended for a few games to start this year. And, you know, this offensive line is still good enough where, you know, it wasn't too long ago Darren McFadden was having a very nice year with Dallas. So he's definitely a guy that could step in similar to what D'Angelo Williams did last year for Le'Veon Bell and kind of carry them through the first two games or so, if that's what the suspension would be. But, you know, Dallas just starts with their line. That's where they've invested picks. That's where they've invested their money. They're dominant. They're the best offensive line in the league. That helps them with the run game. They can dominate teams, dominate time of possession. They don't put as much on Dak, and they don't ask as much as their defense, because if they do, this defense is not very good. They basically reshuffled the entire secondary. They've got so many different players suspended. We'd be on here for 2 hours discussing that, so we won't even get into that. Just know that there's quite a few defensive players and people really on this team that are going to get suspended or dealing with league issues, we'll say. So that to me is just the Cowboys. They're just a smash mouth team. Zeke just wears people out. You know, it's just, you just watch them and they're not really flashy. It's like, you know, Zeke into the line for 3 yards, Zeke in the line for 4 yards, 2 yards, and then bam, he hits them for 50 and a touchdown. That seems to be how they win. They just wear you down And once they get into the third and fourth, I always think of that Steeler game last year where Zeke just was finding massive holes and just exploding through them. And that, you know, basically how they won that game. And Dak really didn't have to do really anything except turn around and hand the ball to Zeke. And that seems to be their formula: wear people out, don't ask a lot of Dak. But when he is asked of something, like in the Packer game, he certainly has the ability to do that. They still have Dez Bryant. Cole Beasley was the guy that popped on the scene last year and looked very good as a slot receiver as well for them. So, you know, I don't see them having 13 win upside, but I definitely think 10 or 11's there.
Do you see them winning the division, or are you sticking with the Giants as probable winners of that division?
I still think I'm going to stick with the Giants just because the Cowboys defense scares me to death. And looking at their roster, and I mean, you know, you wonder about the Hall of Fame game, even that. But I mean, they made Blaine Gabbert look like the second coming of Joe Montana out there. I mean, and you wonder how good they can be even when they start getting their first string guys in. They're just not a good defensive unit. And there's only so much, you know, scheme wise you can do to mask the deficiencies they have on the defensive end. So that's what really scares me and why I think that I could see the Giants winning 11, maybe Dallas winning 10. And winning the division that way. But I think both will end up in the playoffs.
Who are you going to put on your fantasy roster?
I think it's Zeke Elliott is the guy to really look at. I mean, I think he's going to be a top three guy in season long. I think it's going to be some form of either David Johnson, Le'Veon Bell, and then Zeke's going to be right there to go. And then in daily, you know, I think he's a guy that you have to look at. And a lot of times it seems like last year he just got overlooked. Everybody loaded up on David Johnson, Le'Veon Bell. They wanted that 40-point upside, and Zeke just kept chugging along every week after week after week. And, you know, his ownership percentage would still always be fairly low. Sometimes it would even be single digits in some tournaments you were in. So I really like them. Dez has that touchdown upside, but he always hurt.
He burned me so many times last year.
He always finds a way to get himself hurt, or he's off the field for something, you know, but it always seems to be injury related that takes him off. He's had the foot injury and just all these nagging things with him. He just scares me. So he would be a guy, if he falls in the right position season long, you sort of have to take him at the values there, especially if he would fall like the third round, maybe even fourth, depending on how your league is set up and what other people think. But if people start taking him, looking at him in the second round or something like that, the wide receivers are so deep. You know, again, Dez, I think for me, is more of a tournament play for DraftKings. If the matchup is right, he's still a guy that can have massive games with multiple touchdowns, which is huge in daily. So I think those are the plays. And Cole Beasley's another guy to look out for. Certainly, he's going to be a cheap guy to start the year. He's going to be under the radar, but he is a guy that can, you know, he seemed to have a good connection with Dak. So I think he's a guy to keep an eye on because he kind of has that Jamison Crowder type. You know, a guy that can go get you 7 or 8 catches, and he can get to the end zone as well.
Yeah, I liked him in daily fantasy last year. I used him on a number of occasions because at his price tag, if you're playing PPR and he goes out and gets 6 or 7 catches, that's 6 or 7 points right there. And if he's $4,500, $4,200 on daily fantasy, even 7 points plus his yardage, so that probably gets you to 10, 11, 12 points.
3X.
You know, that's great. And then if he happens to grab one of those, you know, 10 to 15 yard touchdowns where they throw seemingly, you know, an entire roster of wide receivers in the end zone at one time and let Dak find somebody, he will come out with the ball 1, 2, 3 times a year on that kind of thing. And if you hit him on that kind of week, you're loving life on daily fantasy. That's one of those dart throws that you always talk about. Now, Justin, one last question on this, and then we'll hit a break and go to our next segment. But we talked about in the AFC review that the South, despite the teams that are in the South, we actually thought the AFC South was going to be the most exciting division simply for the fact that you have so many teams like kind of knotted up right close to each other. To me, in the NFC, unless you count what I think is going to happen in the NFC West with, you know, the Seahawks being good and then the other three just knocking each other all over the place, I think the NFC East is probably going to be the most exciting of the divisions just in terms of divisional rankings. How do you feel about that?
I agree, and I think Vegas agrees too. You only see a 2-win difference between, you know, the Redskins and the Cowboys. Redskins are at 7.5, Dallas is at 9. And really up until last week when we did the AFC West, every other team had a 6-win or less, you know, team in it with either the Bills, the Browns, or the Jacksonville Jaguars. So you started to look that there was a big separation gap between these two teams. You know, just like we said, I think all of these teams have a chance to go 8-8 or better. And I think that will keep this division close. Why I think 10 or 11 wins is going to take this division. And again, they do have to play out of conference is the AFC West, which we think is going to be a tough division. So those are going to be 4 difficult games. I think we'll caused some depression in their win totals as well from last year.
So after the break, we're going to talk about current events. There's a lot of good things to talk about, so we'll be right back at you. Justin, this week on segment two, we decided and we talked about before the show that we had some ideas to do an entire segment of topic on one thing or another, as we've done in the past weeks. But there was just a lot of things that broke this week.
Busy week.
And when I say broke, I don't mean, you know, Ryan Tannehill's knee or Will Fuller's collarbone, but these things did happen. So let's go to that NFL piece first, since we just got done talking about the NFC East. Let's talk about those current event news stories that were coming out of the AFC. As many of the listeners probably know at this point, Ryan Tannehill went down in a practice situation in training camp. It was immediately obvious that something was majorly wrong, and it only took them a day to say, well, we're going to have to pull the plug on his season. He's going to need work done on that knee. I think they probably should have done it last year. I'm not a doctor, but I think now
in retrospect,
it was
a partial tail last year. Why would they even go into this year without doing it?
I'm not sure. In my line of work, I'm a surgical sales rep. I've seen over 100 ACL repairs, you know, other ligament repairs in the knee.
Pass out over here.
And so, you know, you just don't mess around with that kind of thing. And again, I'm not a team doctor. I just know that in this day and age, especially for pros and all of the recovery and training that they have available to them, you see guys coming back from ACL tears, having the surgery done and being really at full strength in 8 to 9 months, which is faster than ever. I don't know what his exact situation was last year, but to put a Band-Aid on it and hope for the best, if you watch that replay, when he's running, he already has a brace on the knee. He's running, as Colin Cowherd likes to say, he's running like a batting cage. He looks awful as he's running. And all he did was play on his foot and just went down. That knee didn't look stable at all.
No, it looked like a ton of instability in there. And even when you watch the video, it just, you know, Ryan Tannehill was a guy that could tuck it away and run and looked very good during it, looked athletic. This was a wide receiver in college, and he just looked so awkward on that play anyways. He just looked very uncomfortable. And, you know, as soon as he seemed to put any type of pressure on the knee, down he went. So that was, I think, my first text to you was, why in the world didn't Miami go through the process of having him get this taken care of? This injury happened, you know, late last year, but, you know, we're talking about this in close to, you know, the middle of August, and he would have had 8+ months to get himself ready. Like, why wouldn't they have just gone ahead and gotten this surgery done? They have a good backup in Matt Moore that could have carried them through the OTAs and even some of the rookie camps or whatever they needed him for. I don't understand why you go in with basically a guy that you think is your franchise quarterback and put him in this position. It makes no sense to me.
And related to our show, we talked about the Jets just being awful and the Bills being mediocre and the Dolphins having a strong wide receiving core. They have pieces there. And if Tannehill's healthy, again, there's that statement, right? If someone, X player X, is healthy, this will happen. Or if he's not, this will happen. And now we get to see that play out, because we spoke very highly of the Dolphins in our first, you know, divisional preview show.
Very favorable
of the AFC
schedule.
East. They have a favorable schedule. We talked highly about them. We talked about them as a potential wild card. And in my mind, this changes everything. Now, let's go to the actual second piece of that lead story, because now you're the Dolphins. Now you have the choice of, do we elevate Matt Moore to us the starter? And now he's probably sitting there thinking, what in the world have I got to do to be a starter again? You bring in Jay Cutler rather than Colin Kaepernick. Jay Cutler at $10 million for 1 year, plus incentives, is what they chose out of their options. Now, last week on when we debuted our new segment called Back Talk, you ranted about Colin Kaepernick. So it wasn't a big surprise to you that he didn't get chosen by Miami. But fill us in a little bit about their thought process and maybe add your own take on what's going on here.
Well, I think it's pretty simple. I mean, Jay Cutler was with Adam Gase in 2015 with Chicago. A lot of people felt like it was Jay Cutler's best year. So when you start looking at, okay, who can we put in and bring in that will know this system when we're basically inside 30 days to go? And Cutler was the guy. And Cutler also was a guy that did not run around in a Fidel Castro shirt, which basically made him a pretty logical choice to go in Miami.
You saw that as a problem?
I think with your Cuban fan base in Miami, having that would have been a major blowback. So no matter how much the media wants to play it as, you know, oh, poor Kaepernick and, you know, he's being blackballed and this and that, I think Stephen Ross would have had a much harder time explaining that to the fan base.
Now, let's talk about that media angle for just one second, because I gave you the 5 minutes on the mic last week, and, you know, we're not doing another back talk this particular week. We're going to have those as special editions.
I got to rest up. Made me tired.
You did a phenomenal job, and I didn't want to break into your rant to say this, but here's just a kind of a point, and one of my buddies who is on a political podcast but is a big sports fan, he has this same point. We were both Tim Tebow fans. Tim Tebow is sort of a similar situation. Now, on the flip side of that coin, what Tebow brings is a media circus, much like Colin Kaepernick. So they equally bring a media circus to the backup quarterback position. There are teams that don't want to deal with that. The thing is, Tebow's was all of his media circus really was not centered around anything negative or controversial or anything like that, unless you call being a Christian controversial, which some do. That's not the point. The point is he didn't do anything wrong, so to speak. And, you know, not that Colin Kaepernick necessarily did anything wrong, but he did something controversial. Did you ever hear the media crying, oh, it's so unfair that Tim Tebow's not getting shots in the NFL? I really didn't. They couldn't kick him out of the league fast enough saying how awful he was. And that might be the case. Statistically, he wasn't very good. But here you go with Kaepernick, and it's this woe is me, and the media is just, it's not fair. Tebow never got that treatment. This is why we talk about the media's agenda being so prevalent, and why we're so much against that is because we don't think as fans you get to hear the truth all the time.
No, I said it last week when we did back talk. Where is the Robert Griffin III backlash? Here's an African American quarterback. He was the 2012 Offensive Rookie of the Year, and he's not on the team either. He's a free agent. Now, it just came out that a team did offer Kaepernick a one-year veteran minimum deal, and it was turned down. And some of the sourcing was, well, it was turned down by Kaepernick because he wants to sort of fan the flames of this whole media uprise and pressure an owner into giving him a multi-year deal. So if that is the case and he has turned down deals, then there's a lot of reporters that need to do a better job of this, because everybody is acting like, oh, it's the NFL owner's fault. They're blackballing him. You know, Doug Baldwin comes out yapping about, you know, oh, I really believe he's blackballed. Doug, I hate to break it to you, but Colin came to Seattle and left with no contract. So you might want to walk upstairs and talk to Pete Carroll and John Schneider and say, why didn't we sign this guy? Or someone do some reporting and find out really what is happening. Because there's other guys that aren't on NFL rosters and there's no talk about. I mean, Tebow had a better win percentage than Kaepernick when he left. I mean, Tebow was on a playoff team that won a game against Pittsburgh. You know, Kaepernick was on a team that he was 1-10 as a starter. And like you said, no one, you know, Tebow basically became a joke. I mean, he was just there because he was clickbait. But most of the stories was, you know, what was happening at Jets camp and this and that. It wasn't, oh my God, we got to figure out a way to get this guy on a roster and get him to play. There was nothing like it is happening with Kaepernick. So yeah, again, that's why we did the back talk segment last week, because the media just doesn't report on all sides of the story. And if you're going to talk about Colin Kaepernick, then it should be followed up with, where is Robert Griffin III in all this? Why is he not getting a phone call? You're going to say he's not one of the top 100 quarterbacks around that should have a job?
Yeah. And let's not forget, listeners, that Colin Kaepernick opted out of his last year of his deal in San Francisco.
$14.5 million.
And he opted out of that. And now that we hear these potential stories coming out that there might have been teams interested at a veteran minimum and one-year deal, and he could possibly be on an NFL roster right now, I think what's happening is the man is betting on himself and he's losing. He is counting on this negative publicity turning into positive momentum to almost play the victim and get this role on a team out of this pressure situation that's cooking, and it's not working out. So the dude bet on himself and he lost, right? I mean, so it's time to stop crying about it.
Yeah, again, a guy like Michael Vick went to jail for 2 years for dogfighting, but he had talent and he was a winning quarterback when he basically left. And teams were willing to take a risk on him because the talent was there. Kaepernick has not shown that type of upside basically over the course of the last 3 years, and has been part of getting three other coaches fired. So why would another head coach just want to bring a guy in? Like, why did the Baltimore Ravens want to bring a guy in that just went 1-10? Just because there's a connection with the offensive coordinator, it doesn't mean he wants to change the entire offense while Joe Flacco's out for 2 weeks nursing a back injury, nor does the team want to take all the baggage that comes with that. So, yeah, I mean, you know, Colin Kaepernick, you could have been sitting there on $14.5 million and sort of assessed your options over the course and let maybe this story sort of simmer down a little bit and go into next year when there's going to be some quarterback needy teams, when maybe the market has changed and the landscape has changed. You opted out of $14.5 million. So this is on you. And if teams are trying to sign you and you don't take the deal because you think you're going to go get a better one, you know, I think you're wrong.
It's time to move on, Colin. It's time to move on. So in that same AFC divisional preview, we talked about fantasy relevant guys, just like we're going to continue to do in the NFC. And two names that came up, one on the Jets roster was Enunwa, and one on the Texans.
Only one.
Yeah, the only one. And one on the Texans roster was Will Fuller. Both of those guys have recently been injured. So where do you see, very quickly, where do you see the impact of those two injuries?
I have no idea even how to formulate for the Jets and what it's going to be. I mean, the other guy we thought was maybe Robbie Anderson would get more of a look, but it's certainly he's really struggling in camp, can't get off press coverage. You know, and then you wonder what they're going to do at quarterback. You know, we were joking around that Hackenberg got thrown out of practice because he can't even get out of the huddle correctly. I mean, this Jets team is staring 0-16 right down the barrel. I mean, Sam Darnold's like, I think I'll stay in USC for however many more years it takes. I mean, you know, Matt Leinart, what did he take, like dance classes or something his fifth year? I think Sam Darnold may be doing that as well if the Jets are sitting there. But I don't really know what the impact will be for the Jets. I mean, somebody is going to have to catch the football for him, but I don't even know at this point if they know who that's going to be. I think maybe Bilal Powell and Matt Forte are going to get more run because, I mean, they may just run the ball 40 plus times a game at this point because I don't know who their pass catchers or who's going to quarterback for them. And then for the Texans, you know, the Fuller injury is tough because he is a guy that showed a lot of upside last year, even with Brock. You know, and then he went through that stretch where he just seemed to have a lot of drops on him. So I think they're definitely a team that needs him back because they need to get him as that deep threat to help take some of the coverage off of DeAndre Hopkins. So I think that impact could be on the fact that, you know, instead of having that deep threat that can kind of take some of the, you know, take some of the pressure off DeAndre with, you know, taking the safety over the top when he runs those deep routes. You know, Savage, by all impressions, is having a really nice camp. Hopkins is big on him, just endorsed him that he should be the starter. They said he can make all the throws. So, you know, Bill O'Brien needs to get himself back looking like a quarterback guru because the guy he got rid of, Osweiler, you know, Brock is going to be starting the preseason for the Browns. So, you know, Bill O'Brien needs to get a quarterback and to develop him, or at some point, you know, the leash is going to get really short for him and he may be looking for a job because the Texans have to take a step forward and he keeps running through all these quarterbacks and can't get someone. If you're a quarterback guru, at some point you got to land one of these guys.
The NFL is by far one of the most interesting things happening in current events right now, probably because with training camp going on, you don't know what each day is going to bring. Every day, unfortunately, is going to bring an injury. And we said it before, we hate it when the best players aren't on the field. So we hate it when big name players, fantasy relevant players, you know, key parts of the roster get injured because it just reduces the quality of the product. So we don't like seeing that. But let's switch gears here and head to the NASCAR garage. And we just talked about how sad, quote unquote, sad Rick Hendrick must have been when Casey Kane won the Brickyard 400.
Now we know why.
Now we know why. And look, it clearly didn't save him his job, right? So Casey Kane won the Brickyard 400 not 2 weeks ago, and this week he lost his job.
Not a surprise to us. I mean, we said it as soon as Rick Hendrick really wouldn't commit. When he said we don't know our plans for 2018, when you don't even say something like, well, you know, Casey's our guy, we just need to put the sponsorship together behind him, we really want him behind the wheel. When you start becoming that non-committal, you know the news is going to break. And like you said, he's probably, Rick Hendrick was probably the only owner actually maybe a little bit disappointed to see a guy like Casey Kane win, because then it makes this, you know, this topic, no one would argue this had this happened and Casey didn't win. I mean, everyone would have expected it because Casey Kane, you know, by all accounts, just has underperformed and underwhelmed.
Yeah, his last two years. Yeah, his last 2 years were definitely declining. He's missing the chase. He's not winning races. We led a couple weeks ago by talking about the sponsorship issues in NASCAR. And, you know, two of his primary sponsors are going away. So the writing was on the wall for Casey Kane. It just wasn't working out. Now stories are breaking that he just hasn't even been happy there. It sounds like it's probably going to be a good breakup. And I think my prediction is still on the table that Casey Kane ends up with Stuart Haas Racing, because as we know, Kurt Busch isn't going to, or possibly isn't going to be in the 41. I really don't think he is. I just think as stories like that sit out there and you know, kind of percolate, it would be more obvious if he was going to be there. We see that in sports all the time, whether it be player contracts or deals in NASCAR. It just, you can tell when the writing's on the wall. We don't know if Danica will be back. So I still predict Casey Kane ends up being in the third or fourth car for Stuart Haas Racing. Now, let's talk about the news that broke today. Who's going in the five?
Yeah, so really, and again, no surprise to us. We speculated last week that William Byron is going to be in, moved up from the Xfinity Series from Junior Motorsports to the five car next year.
So Hendrick has a fantastic stable now of young up-and-coming drivers and then a seven-time champion in Jimmy Johnson. It's hard to argue that with Chase Elliott and William Byron and, of course, Alex Bowman taking the 88, that there isn't a lot of promise there heading into the future. Now it's going to be interesting because now we look at how many more years does Jimmy Johnson have. So we'll certainly, you know, be following that story because he could up and retire like a Carl Edwards, you know, without much notice, and people wouldn't be too, I don't think they'd be too shocked by it. I mean, he's accomplished more than he ever
dreamed. Especially if he can win eight. You know, if he breaks the record and gets to eight championships, I think it becomes even more of a possibility that he eventually could walk away. He has two young daughters, I believe. You know, he seems like he's into other things outside of NASCAR, certainly with the triathletes and the biking and things he's into. So I could certainly see that. The thing that scares me some about Hendrick is, you know, just looking at the stats, I was just curious about like what Casey Kane had done. And one of the most shocking things I saw was Jimmy Johnson and Jeff Gordon over their careers in 48 car and a 24 car respectively, 59.6% of the times they've started, they finished in the top 10. Casey Wow. Kane was at 35%. So it, and even Dale Earnhardt Jr. is at 41%. Of the time. So those guys have set such a high bar. Sometimes I wonder, you know, what happens with those other two teams, basically with Hendrick Motorsports, that they've just cycled through different drivers and they've always sort of had the same results. Now, Chase Elliott, he has 58 career starts in the 24 car. He has 29 top five. So he's in that 50% of the time. He's in the top 10. And you saw Rick Hendrick reward him with a pretty big extension just this year. So there's still a lot of pressure on Alex Bowman and William Byron, because the bar has been set so high of how good this equipment really is that six out of every 10 times they start a NASCAR race, Jimmy Johnson and Jeff Gordon were getting their cars into the top 10. That means they're running up front. That means that the sponsors, you know, are getting that exposure they want. And here you have Casey Kane. That's basically, you know, about three out of every 10 time he runs that he's getting in the top 10. That's a big difference. And that's really, I think, what Rick Hendrick saw of like, look, we're giving this guy the same equipment, supposedly, that we're giving these other drivers, and they're doing this with it, and Casey has done really nothing close to that.
And think of the guys that have filtered through that five car, even when it was the 25. You're talking names like Kyle Busch and Mark Martin and Brian Vickers and now Casey Kane. These aren't no-name drivers that have not had the level of success that, of course, Jeff Gordon and Jimmy Johnson have had. So certainly something is, I don't know what it is, if it's a miss or if it's just, look, I mean, Gordon and Johnson were the dominant cars in that stable, and maybe it's even a mental, you know, a mental block there.
Yeah,
where,
and it's tough,
they
because
feel third fiddle.
They're probably going to go down as two of the best drivers of all time. So it is a tough comparison, but you just wonder, you know, what does the top at Hendrick Motorsports from Rick Hendrick on down, what do they really expect from these other cars? Because it seemed like for the last few years, they have not been happy with Casey Kane's performance. If this wasn't Dale Jr.'s retirement year, there would be a lot more out on him of like, what is happening with him? How come he's not winning more races? I think that pressure would be there as well, where now everybody just wants to see him win. You know, it's either win or bust type scenario. So, you know, if he blows up, no one really cares because it wasn't going to be a win. So, you know, those are two cars both that have underperformed this year. But again, you're comparing them to guys that with, you know, 93 wins in Jeff Gordon and 83 with Jimmy Johnson, you know, some of the top drivers of all time. But you sort of wonder, okay, you know, we're putting good guys. Are these the same cars? Are we putting the same personnel around these guys that we put around Jimmy Johnson and Jeff Gordon? Because it just, the performance has never seemed to be there consistently with anybody that cycled through those other two cars outside the 24 and the 48.
Yeah, the 88, I'd like to talk about this on another segment and another show and talk about it at length. Let's let the season play out. But you're absolutely right. Dale Jr.'s season is abysmal. And it's really sad because it is going to be his last season with the things that he's went through with the concussion last year and things. This isn't unfortunately going to be one of those situations where he changes his mind, I don't think, and says, well, it was a really bad year. I want to try one more year. This is unfortunately for him just a really, really bad year. And a lot of those things have been mechanical failures. They haven't all been his fault. But let's transition into one other thing that's current in NASCAR right now that has some people kind of worked up a little bit, and that's these 3 o'clock, 3:30 start times.
Oh.
It used to be that your West Coast races would be your Sonoma, your Auto Club Speedway in California would be your 3 o'clock, 3:30 start times. NASCAR has now gone, and their you know late summer schedule is all 3 o'clock start times for the most part. And everything I'm reading on Twitter and in some of the social media avenues is that the fans are really not liking it too much. And I got to be honest, as someone we've talked about who watches PGA golf a lot, my Sundays used to be really kind of nice. I would get home from church. I would get my NASCAR from like 12:30 and it would kind of be over by 4. By that time, I can catch the last 12 to 15 holes of the final groupings in the PGA tournament, and that ends at 6:30. During football season, you'd have the final chase races of the NASCAR season happening from 1 to 4, and then, of course, I'd flip back and forth for the 1 o'clock NFL games, but then I'd have my 4 o'clock NFL games all set. Now I've got to be bouncing all over the place because, really, literally, you know, in the beginning, before football, there's nothing on Sunday afternoon in that 12 to 3 o'clock time frame. And then now all of a sudden you got everything on from 3 to 6 o'clock. I don't think NASCAR has thought this through because their numbers, as we've talked about, are already down. Fans are talking about how much they hate it. Even track owners, Watkins Glen, who just had a sellout, their owner has come out on Twitter and said, that's fine, we just sold this race out, but we hate that start time. This is not a good marketing plan for them, and I think it's going to be detrimental once these other sports start back up.
It's awful. I hate it. I mean, I never understood, why would you want to go against the NFL anyways? I mean, they're the juggernaut. You're not going to beat them, so you have to find ways around them. And they've even gotten, you know, they want to get rid of some of their Saturday night races in the chase, and I just don't get those moves. If I was NASCAR, I would try to figure out how to start the races at like 11 o'clock in the morning and run them up until they finish at 2, and then you don't even have to deal with the NFL. I think most race fans would probably give up an hour of the first quarter of an NFL game to watch the end of a race and don't even go against it. Most people are sitting at home watching, you know, setting their fantasy lineups, you know, probably playing on Twitter, flipping through and seeing what the news is. Why even go against them? And now you have tracks that don't even have lights, that you're starting at 3 o'clock. If they get any type of rain or delay, the race is going to get pushed back till Monday, or they're going to be finishing at 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night, running into, just like they did at the Brickyard, oh, well, are we going to finish with darkness? It doesn't make any sense from a fan perspective. We early on, we talked about how we went to Dover, and luckily we were there for an early start in the summer. You know, I can't imagine that race starting at 3 o'clock and getting over at close to 7 and then trying to get into a car and drive home and not get home till 10. Like, your whole entire Sunday is blown. I mean, you got to basically go home, go to bed, and try to get up and go to work. And some fans, I think, are just turned off by that. Certainly, you know, as fans of Dale Jr.'s podcast, he has come on basically every single week and criticized the 3 o'clock starts because for the race teams, it's even tougher by the time they get done and fly home and actually get home to bed. It's, you know, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. And then they got to turn around and do it again on Monday to get up and get back to the shop. It's so short-sighted. I don't see why. You know, it's the TV partners. You know, they have a lot to do with this. Well, your ratings continue to drop, and your fan base is upset with it. Why continue to do something that drives people away? That's the whole problem with this sport, and that's a whole other podcast, is that the fact that the sport is a sport that catered to the South, and that's where their success was. And the more that they got away from that, the more decline the sport has continued to have. And now they just keep chasing an audience. And maybe NASCAR is just not a sport for everyone. And it doesn't have to be. It's sort of like the election. You know, you don't have to make everybody like you. You just have to make enough to either win or make enough to make your TV partners happy. NASCAR doesn't need 30 million people watching it. What they need is to get back to where they, you know, had 5 or 7 million viewers a week watching it, and their TV partners would be happy. And instead, they just keep just basically crapping on the fan base by giving them this product that now you have to sit around till, and it's not even a 3 o'clock start. They actually don't drop the green till closer to 3:30 most races. And again, you know, if there's any type of rain, you're sitting around till 9 o'clock at night trying to watch the end of a race. It's just completely ridiculous and so short-sighted by NASCAR.
Well, that's it for our current events segment for this week. We think that we might do that more because, you know, it's nice to have two segments where you really dig into two topics in depth. But there are times when we just got to hit some of the news stories, and we didn't hit them all for sure. I mean, the Dodgers, look at their record in the last 50 games is unbelievable.
43-7, best since 1912. I mean, we don't even talk a lot of baseball, but that's something that you got to bring up. I mean, they're playing some incredible baseball.
Yeah, there's a lot that could be said there. Bryce Harper is still having one of his career years. And, you know, he's 26 years old. When he was 24, he had one of these years. The guy's not going away. Mike Trout, at the age of I think he's 24, and he just hit his 1,000th hit. I mean, there's a lot of good players in baseball. So there's, you know, a lot of good things happening in the world of sports that we just simply don't have the time to cover at all. But I think these current events segments could pay off in terms of just getting a little bit more content out to our listeners in one show versus stringing it out over a couple.
Yeah, and it gives us a chance to kind of banter back and forth a little bit, like just like we really set the show up to do, is kind of being able to talk through topics, talk through what was going on, kind of give our take on what the media is trying to spin things around and do it in a quicker manner and hit a lot of things. And we're finally at that point where, you know, like Eric talked about earlier, with training camp, you're literally getting, you know, 5 to 10 stories a day from different camps with either players that are up, players that are down, injuries, news that's breaking with depth charts. So in the coming weeks, we'll have lots of this, and this might be a regular thing as we get into the NFL season.
Well, speaking of that banter, we got to move on to our lightning round. So after this, we'll hit the lightning round, and I'm sure you want to banter with me about Steph Curry.
Oh, yeah. Well, Eric, your favorite NBA player, or the man that's given you a few nightmares over the last few years.
I still don't know why you're calling him my favorite NBA player.
Steph Curry decided to step out and to do one of his hobbies and kind of take it more seriously when he stepped onto the course for the Web.com Tour in his first professional start, shot 274s, missed the cut, but I think he represented himself well. Even as a Steph hater a little bit, what was your thoughts when you saw him on the golf course?
Yeah, I mean, he's a rival of LeBron James, and there's no other way to put that when you have three final series in 3 years.
Rivalry to LeBron.
Yeah, don't say it to LeBron, but sorry, LeBron, it's a rivalry. Steph Curry is a phenomenal basketball player, one of the best three-point shooters I've ever seen. And moving over to the golf course, I was very interested. I gave him a full look. I gave him my honest attention, and I was pretty impressed. He looked very nervous when he got started on Thursday. There's no doubt about that. He really scraped it around quite a bit, and they're not going to show that too much on the highlights, but if you watched his whole round, it wasn't tee to green. It wasn't very pretty. But here's what I'm most impressed with. To shoot a 74 two times and in pro-level conditions is not easy to do. And so right off the bat, my initial take on it is he's obviously got just innate athleticism because he probably doesn't play that much golf throughout the NBA season. And so this is a hobby, like you said, for him. The fact that he has enough athleticism to go out there and compete and really not make a fool of himself, I didn't know if he would shoot 84. I mean, the amount of pressure that was on him was intense. Because the world was watching, the world wanted to know, and there was a lot of people that had negative things to say about him doing this. They thought, well, you know, I don't really buy into this argument, but they thought that he's taking a spot from another guy who is actually doing this as a career and yada, yada, yada. I just don't buy into that because it's a sponsor exemption. The sponsors have exemptions to give to whomever they want to give it to, and it's to boost the marketability of that event. Period. The end.
And it's the Web.com Tour.
If these guys want to earn
more notoriety to them than they've had in how long?
They earn their way. I mean, so he's not taking a spot from a guy who's trying to earn his way on. Those guys are trying to earn their way on, and they're playing every week. So that's really a moot point for me. But look, despite what I think of him and his rivalry with LeBron, I was super impressed. Like I said, he scraped it around, but you can make bogeys and double bogeys really quick when you're scraping it around like he was, and he wasn't doing that. He was hitting nice chips. He was making par putts over and over and over. He had some birdies. So he can say that he played on a pro tour and made birdies on a pro tour. I think he represented himself very well. He did not look like a fool. He he really pulled off quite a remarkable feat to shoot that consistently 2 days in a row under the amount of pressure he was under. So my hat's off to him.
Oh, my, Steph. Big praise from a man that's not always got the nicest things to say about you.
Well, we talk about fantasy relevancy for all of these divisions and the players on the teams. So, Justin, as we were kind of reviewing DraftKings, and you know, I dabble in that, and you're good at it. So, you noticed something today about the DraftKings salaries for the NFL in the first week. What was kind of on your mind as you were looking through this first week one options?
Yeah, so they just released them this week for DraftKings, so week one, so you get a lot of time to percolate and sit there and second guess yourself for the next month. But I really thought that, you know, outside the running backs with David Johnson and Le'Veon Bell, who you probably would anticipate would be the highest guys they were towards the end of last year, the pricing is very fair. I think it's going to be a really fun first week. I think the ownership will sort of get spread out. You know, the pricing seems very fair, especially with the quarterback. You know, your most expensive one is Ben Roethlisberger at 7,300. Even at wide receiver, Antonio Brown starts out at 8,800, and you can get a guy like, you know, Odell Beckham for $8,300. So I think there's really some good value plays. You got some opportunity to make some nice stacks with your quarterback wide receiver combination. You know, even the Bills defense going against the Jets is only 3,900, where last year some of those defenses were getting over 4,000. So what stood out to me was, you know, a very nice price base where I don't think you know, it'll be interesting how the running back position continues to grow. You know, last year DraftKings kind of blew it out where you had, you know, David Johnson and Le'Veon Bell were close to 10 grand at some points during the later part of the year when they were really, you know, scoring at the points that they were. So a very fair pricing right now. I think that's going to lead to a lot of parity. You know, even a guy like we talked about just on this episode, Terrell Pryor, is 6,100 as a wide receiver. So a very nice price point. You know, we talked Marshawn Lynch last week. He's at 5,300. So some really nice names that we think could have some very impactful years at very reasonable prices that I think is going to give some chances to build some pretty creative lineups.
So do you think that this is because we're at week one, you know, coming up, this is for week one, and the slate is clean? Or do you think this is possibly a new, slightly adjusted strategy that DraftKings is trying so that there can be more variability in the rosters that are chosen?
I think it's a little bit of both. Probably more to your first point that this is the first season of trying to take some stuff from last year. For example, a player like Allen Robinson's 5,200, I believe. So they've certainly looked at his results from last year. DeAndre Hopkins, 5,900. So they've taken some players that had some rough years and they've sort of, you know, extrapolated that out to this year that they haven't, you know, gone through the roof. But if those guys have, you know, a few good weeks, they're going to be up there in the $7,000-$8,000 range very quickly. But I hope that they do stay with this kind of pricing where they allow for, you know, more, where you're more enticed to kind of build some more creative lineups where the ownership percentage isn't so much on one guy. You know, last year just got out of control with, you know, even at their price point, you know, Bell and Johnson were both owned in, you know, 30 plus percent, sometimes 40 plus percent when you got to the tournaments. And they're also looking at, you know, a guy like Darren McFadden with the Zeke Elliott potential suspension news. They've already got him at 6,100, which is crazy for a backup running back. There's nobody even close to that. So they've already sort of built in like, okay, if Zeke's suspended, you're still going to have a decision to make if you want to spend $6,000 on Darren McFadden, where, you know, last year I think they would have went in where McFadden would have probably been a minimum salary guy or, you know, maybe $4,000 at the most, where everybody would have been on him. If Zeke is suspended, the ownership would have been 50% plus for most of your tournaments. And I think they're at least doing some of those things. So I think that will continue with DraftKings. It seemed like, you know, that dynamic pricing is sort of going to be there with them. It's just, can they kind of keep it under control where, you know, the quarterback, one of the positions can't all be crazy like it was. You can't have $10,000 receivers and $10,000 running backs. It hurts everybody because you're either building up and everybody's taking that guy who's filling in for someone, and then the ownership percentages get all screwed up. So I like the fact that they, you know, for week one and even week two, I think will be a pretty a balanced pricing until players really start to separate themselves as the season goes on.
So let me ask you this fun question. Based on what we know now, and of course that could change in a minute, but based on what we know now and based on the fun pricing structure that you have there on your DraftKings app, who would you pick for quarterback in week one?
Oh, man, I haven't even really looked at the matchups yet, but you have Ben Roethlisberger versus Cleveland. I mean, it's 7,300. That's a pretty nice play just right off the bat. And even Aaron Rodgers at 7,000. I mean, they've got Seattle. It's a tougher one. But I mean, the pricing, you know, even a guy like, you know, when you get down to a Kirk Cousins versus a very weak, you know, Eagles secondary.
Wait, what?
Sorry to break your heart, but you know, you could do a Cousins prior stack it and be at 12,500. Cousins is at 6,400. Prior's at 61. So 12,500, you get your quarterback, wide receiver, one stack versus a weak secondary. So there's some really good plays in there once you start to get through the preseason, see how the injuries work out, start to see some of these matchups, and even the Bills get your Jets. So I think LeSean McCoy is going to get locked and loaded by a lot
just
of people.
Stack that whole team.
Yeah, the earliest thing of McCoy is they could be up so much he didn't even play the second half. So whoever they started the second running back behind McCoy might be the guy to take.
Well, it was a lot of fun talking DraftKings and NFL as we always do. We just, like you said, we just do this for fun. And it's just, it's a nice back and forth to be able to discuss what we think might happen. And I'm still heartbroken over the earlier part of the show because there's no way that the Eagles are finishing third or fourth in that division. There's just no way.
I think you're going to be disappointed.
Don't forget to hit us up on Twitter at TalkBackFanTalk. And also, we want to thank BlogTalkRadio.com.
Yeah, again, our Twitter feed is at TalkBackFanTalk. I'm TalkBackJustin. Eric is at TalkBackEric. Give us a follow. Give us some comments. Like I said, we always are willing to take questions, comments, feedback.
Yeah, send us questions. Let us know what you want to hear on the lightning round. We're happy to ask just about anything as long as it's sports related. But we'll see. We'll filter them first. We'll filter them first now. Well, thanks for listening to this episode. It's been episode 14. We're in the almost the end of the third month. So we do appreciate the support from our listeners and from blogtalkradio.com and Apple iTunes. So until next week, I'm Eric.
And I'm Justin.
Have a good one.